Star Food by Ethan Kanin. The summer I turned 18, I disappointed both my parents for the first time. This hadn't happened before, since what disappointed one usually pleased the other. As a child, if I played broom hockey instead of going to school, my mother wept and my father took me outside later to find out how many goals I'd scored. On the other hand, if I spent Saturday afternoon on the roof of my parents' grocery store, staring up at the clouds instead of counting cracker cartons in the stockroom, my father took me to the back to talk about work and discipline, and my mother told me later to keep looking for things that no one else saw. This was her theory. My mother felt that men like Leonardo da Vinci and Thomas Edison had simply stared long enough at regular objects until they saw new things, and thus my looking into the sky might someday make me a great man. She believed I had a worldly curiosity. My father believed I wanted to avoid stock work. Stock work was an issue in our family, as were all the jobs that had to be done in a grocery store. Our store was called Star Food, and above it an incandescent star revolved. Its circuits buzzed, and its yellow points as thick as my knees drooped with the slow melting of the bulb. On summer nights, flying insects flocked in clouds around it, droves of them burning on the glass. One of my jobs was to go out on the roof, the sloping, eaved side that looked over the western half of Arcade, California, and clean them off the star. At night, when their black bodies stood out against the glass, when the wind carried in the marsh smell of the New Jerusalem River, I went into the attic, crawled out the dormer window onto the peaked roof, and slid across the shingles to where the pole rose like a lightning rod into the night. I reached with a wet rag and rubbed away the June bugs and pickerel moths until the star was yellow-white and steaming from the moisture. Then I turned and looked over Arcade, across the bright avenue and my dimly lighted high school in the distance, into the low hills where oak trees grew in rows on the curbs and where girls drove to school in their own convertibles. When my father came up on the roof sometimes to talk about the store, we fixed our eyes on the red tile roofs, or the small clouds of blue barbecue smoke that floated above the hills on warm evenings. While the clean bulb buzzed and flickered behind us, we talked about loss leaders, or keeping the elephant ear plums stacked in neat triangles. The summer I disappointed my parents, though. My father talked to me about a lot of other things. He also made me look in the other direction whenever we were on the roof together, not west to the hills and their clouds of barbecue smoke, but east toward the other part of town. We crawled up one slope of the roof, then down the other so that I could see beyond the back alley where wash hung on lines in the moonlight, down to the neighborhoods across Route 5. These were the neighborhoods where men sat on the curbs on weekday afternoons, where rusted, wheelless cars lay on blocks in the yards. "You're going to end up on one of those curbs," my father told me. Usually I stared farther into the clouds when he said something like that. He and my mother argued about what I did on the roof for so many hours at a time, and I hoped that by looking closely at the amazing borders of clouds I could confuse him. My mother believed I was on the verge of discovering something atmospheric, and I was sure she told my father this, so when he came upstairs, made me look across Route 5, and talked to me about how I was going to end up there, I squinted harder at the sky. "You don't fool me for a second," he said. He was up on the roof with me, because I had been letting someone steal from the store. From the time we first had the star on the roof, my mother believed her only son was destined for limited fame. Limited because she thought that true vision was distilled and could not be appreciated by everybody. I discovered this shortly after the star was installed, when I spent an hour looking out over the roofs and chimneys instead of helping my father stock a shipment of dairy. It was a hot day, and the milk sat on the loading dock while he searched for me in the store and in our apartment next door. When he came up and found me, his neck was red and his footfalls shook the roof joists. At my age, I was still allowed certain mistakes, but I'd seen the dairy truck arrive, and I knew I should have been downstairs, so it surprised me later, after I'd helped unload the milk, when my mother stopped beside me as I was sprinkling the leafy vegetables with a spray bottle. "Dade, I don't want you to let anyone keep you from what you ought to be doing." "I'm sorry," I said. "I should have helped with the milk earlier." No, she said. That's not what I mean. Then she told me her theory of limited fame while I sprayed the cabbage and lettuce with the atomizer. It was the first time I had heard her idea. The world's most famous men, she said, presidents and emperors, generals and patriots, were men of vulgar fame, men who ruled the world because their ideas were obvious and could be understood by everybody. But there was also limited fame. Newton and Galileo and Enrico Fermi were men of limited fame. And as I stood there with the atomizer in my hand, my mother's eyes watered over, and she told me she knew in her heart that one day I was going to be a man of limited fame. I was 12 years old. After that day, I found I could avoid a certain amount of stockwork by staying up on the roof and staring into the fine layers of stratus clouds that floated above Arcade. In the Encyclopedia Americana, I read about cirrus and cumulus and thunderheads, about inversion layers and currents like the currents at sea, and in the afternoons I went upstairs and watched. The sky was a changing thing, I found out. It was more than a blue sheet. Twirling with pollen and sunlight, it began to transform itself. Often, as I stood on the roof, my father came outside and swept the sidewalk across the street. Through the telephone poles and crossed power lines, he looked up at me, his broom strokes small and fierce as if he were hoeing hard ground. It irked him that my mother encouraged me to stay on the roof. He was a short man with direct habits and an understanding of how to get along in the world, and he believed that God rewarded only two things, courtesy and hard work. God did not reward looking at the sky. In the car, my father acknowledged good drivers, and in restaurants he left good tips. He knew the names of his customers. He never sold a rotten vegetable. He shook hands often, looked everyone in the eye, and on Friday nights when we went to the movies, he made us sit in the front row of the theater. "Why should I pay to look over other people's shoulders?" he said. The movies made him talk. On the way back to the car, he walked with his hands clasped behind him and greeted everyone who passed. He smiled. He mentioned the fineness of the evening as if he were the admiral or aviator we had just seen on the screen. "People like it," he said. "It's good for business." My mother was quiet, walking with her slender arms folded in front of her as if she were cold. I liked the movies because I imagined myself doing everything the heroes did, deciding to invade at daybreak, swimming half the night against the seaward current. But whenever we left the theater, I was disappointed. From the front row, life seemed like a clear set of decisions. But on the street afterward, I realized that the world existed all around me and I didn't know what I wanted. The quiet of the evening and the ordinariness of human voices startled me. Sometimes on the roof, as I stared into the layers of the horizon, the sounds on the street faded into the same ordinariness. One afternoon, when I was standing under the star, my father came outside and looked up at me. "You're in a trance," he called. I glanced down at him, then squinted back at the horizon. For a minute he waited, and then, from across the street, he threw a rock. He had a pitcher's arm and could have hit me if he wanted, but the rock sailed past me and clattered on the shingles. My mother came right out of the store anyway and stopped him. "I wanted him off the roof," I heard my father tell her later in the same frank voice in which he explained his position to vegetable salesmen. "If someone's throwing rocks at him, he'll come down. He's no fool." I was flattered by this, but my mother won the point, and from then on I could stay up on the roof when I wanted. To appease my father, I cleaned the electric star, and though he often came outside to sweep, he stopped telling me to come down. I thought about limited fame and spent a lot of time noticing the sky. When I looked closely, it was a sea with waves and shifting colors, wind seams and denials of distance, and after a while I learned to look at it so that it entered my eye whole. It was blue liquid. I spent hours looking into its pale wash, looking for things, though I didn't know what. I looked for lines or sectors, the diamond shapes of daylight stars. Sometimes silver-winged jets from the Air Force base across the hills turned the right way against the sun and went off like small flash bulbs on the horizon. There was nothing that struck me and stayed, though, nothing with the brilliance of white light or electric explosion that I thought came with discovery. So after a while, I changed my idea of discovery. I just stood on the roof and stared. When my mother asked me, I told her that I might be seeing new things, but that seeing change took time. It's slow, I told her. It may take years. The first time I let her steal, I chalked it up to surprise. I was working the front register when she walked in, a tall, thin woman in a plaid dress that looked wilted. She went right to the stand-up display of cut price, nearly expired breads and crackers, where she took a loaf of rye from the shelf. Then she turned and looked me in the eye. We were looking into each other's eyes when she walked out the front door. Through the blue and white "Look Up to Star Food" sign on the window, I watched her cross the street. There were two or three other shoppers in the store, and over the tops of the potato chip packages, I could see my mother's broom. My father was in back unloading chicken parts. Nobody else had seen her come in. Nobody had seen her leave. I locked the cash drawer and walked to the aisle where my mom was sweeping. I think someone just stole. My mother wheeled a trash receptacle when she swept, and as I stood there, she closed it, put down her broom, and wiped her face with her handkerchief. You couldn't get him? It was a her. A lady. I couldn't chase her. She came in and took a loaf of rye and left. I had chased plenty of shoplifters before. They were kids, usually, in sneakers and coats too warm for the weather. I chased them up the aisle and out the door, then to the corner and around it, while ahead of me they tried to toss whatever it was, Twinkies, Freeze Pops, into the sidewalk hedges. They cried when I caught them, begged me not to tell their parents. First time, my father said, scare them real good. Second time, call the law. I took them back with me to the store, held them by the collar as we walked. Then I sat them in the straight-backed chair in the stockroom and gave them a speech my father had written. It was printed on a blue index card taped to the door. "Do you know what you have done?" it began. "Do you know what it is to steal?" I learned to pause between the questions, pace the room, check the card. "Give them time to get scared," my father said. He was expert at this. He never talked to them until he had dusted the vegetables or rung a couple of women through the register. "Why should I stop my work for a kid who steals from me?" he said. When he finally came into the stockroom, he moved and spoke the way policemen do at the scene of an accident. His manner was slow and deliberate. First, he asked me what they had stolen. If I had recovered whatever it was, he took it and held it up to the light, turned it over in his fingers as if it were of large value. Then he opened the freezer door and led the kid inside to talk about law and punishment amid the frozen beef carcasses. He paced as he spoke, breathed clouds of vapor into the air. In the end, though, my mother usually got him to let them off. Once, when he wouldn't, when he had called the police to pick up a third offense boy who sat trembling in the stockroom, my mother called him to the front of the store to talk to a customer. In the stockroom, we kept a key to the back door hidden under a silver samovar that had belonged to my grandmother, and when my father was in front that afternoon, my mother came to the rear, took it out, and opened the back door. She leaned down to the boy's ear. "Run," she said. The next time she came in, it happened the same way. My father was at the vegetable tier, stacking avocados. My mother was in back, listening to the radio. It was afternoon. I rang in a customer, then looked up while I was putting the milk cartons in the bottom of the bag, and there she was. Her gray eyes were looking into mine. She had two cans of pineapple juice in her hands, and on the way out, she held the door for an old woman. That night, I went up to clean the Star. The air was clear. It was warm. When I finished wiping the glass, I moved out over the edge of the eaves and looked into the distance where little turquoise squares, lighted swimming pools, stood out against the hills. "Dade?" It was my father's voice from behind the peak of the roof. "Yes?" "Come over to this side." I mounted the shallow pitched roof, went over the peak, and edged down the other slope to where I could see his silhouette against the lights on Route 5. He was smoking. I got up and we stood together at the edge of the shingled eaves. In front of us, trucks rumbled by on the interstate, their trailers lit at the edges like the mast lights of ships. "Look across the highway," he said. "I am." "What do you see?" "Cars." "What else?" "Trucks." For a while, he didn't say anything. He dragged a few times on his cigarette, then pinched off the lid end and put the rest back in the pack. A couple of motorcycles went by, a car with one headlight, a bus. "Do you know what it's like to live in a shack?" he said. "No." "You don't want to end up in a place like that, and it's damn easy to do if you don't know what you want. You know how easy it is?"
"Easy," I said.
"You have to know what you want."
For years, my father had been trying to teach me competence and industry. Since I was 9, I had been squeeze-drying mops before returning them to the closet, double-counting change, sweeping under the lip of the vegetable bins, even if the dirt there was invisible to the customers. On the basis of industry, my father said, Star Food had grown from a 2-aisle, 1-freezer corner store to the largest grocery in Arcade. When I was 8, he had bought the failing gas station next door and built additions, so that now Star Food had 9 aisles, separate coolers for dairy, soda, and beer, a tiered vegetable stand, a glass-fronted butcher counter, a part-time butcher, and under what used to be the rain roof of the failing gas station, free parking while you shopped. When I started high school, we moved into the apartment next door, and at meals we discussed store improvements. Soon my father invented a grid system for easy location of foods. He stayed up one night and painted, and the next morning there was a new coordinate system on the ceiling of the store. It was a grid, A through J, 1 through 10. For weeks there were drops of blue paint in his eyelashes. A few days later, my mother pasted up fluorescent stars among the grid squares. She knew about the real constellations and was accurate with the ones she stuck to the ceiling, even though she also knew that the aisle lights and Star Food stayed on day and night, so that her stars were going to be invisible. We saw them only once, in fact, in a blackout a few months later, when they lit up in hazy clusters around the store.
"Do you know why I did it?" she asked me the night of the blackout as we stood beneath their pale light.
"No."
"Because of the idea."
She was full of ideas, and one was that I was accomplishing something on that shallow pitched section of our roof. Sometimes she sat at the dormer window and watched me. Through the glass, I could see the slender outlines of her cheekbones.
"What do you see?" she asked.
On warm nights, she leaned over the sill and pointed out the constellations.
"They are the illumination of great minds," she said.
After the woman walked out the second time, I began to think a lot about what I wanted. I tried to discover what it was, and I had an idea it would come to me on the roof. In the evenings, I sat up there and thought. I looked for signs. I threw pebbles down into the street and watched where they hit. I read the newspaper, and stories about ballplayers and jazz musicians began to catch my eye. When he was 10 years old, Johnny Unitas strung a tire from a tree limb and spent afternoons throwing a football through it as it swung. Dizzy Gillespie played with an orchestra when he was 7. There was an emperor who ruled China at age 8. What could be said about me? He swept the dirt no one could see under the lip of the vegetable bins. The day after the woman had walked out the second time, my mother came up on the roof while I was cleaning the star. She usually wore medium heels and stayed away from the shingled roof, but that night she came up. I had been over the glass once when I saw her coming through the dormer window, skirt hem and white shoes lit by moonlight. Most of the insects were cleaned off and steam was drifting up into the night. She came through the window, took off her shoes, and edged down the roof until she was standing next to me at the star.
"It's a beautiful night," she said.
"Cool.
Dade, when you're up here, do you ever think about what is in the mind of a great man when he makes a discovery?"
The night was just making its transition from the thin sky to the thick. The air was taking on weight, and at the horizon, distances were shortening. I looked out over the plain and tried to think of an answer. That day, I had been thinking about a story my father occasionally told. Just before he and my mother were married, he took her to the top of the hills that surround Arcade. They stood with the New Jerusalem River, Western California, and the sea on their left, and Arcade on their right. My father has always planned things well, and that day, as they stood in the hill pass, a thunderstorm covered everything west, while Arcade, shielded by hills, was lit by the sun. he asked her which way she wanted to go. She must have realized it was a test, because she thought for a moment and then looked to the right. And when they drove down from the hills that day, my father mentioned the idea of a grocery. Starfood didn't open for a year after, but that was its conception, I think, in my father's mind. That afternoon, as they stood with the New Jerusalem flowing behind them, the plains before them, and my mother in a cotton skirt she had made herself, I think my father must have seen right to the end of his life. I had been trying to see right through to the end of my life, too, but these thoughts never led me in any direction. Sometimes I sat and remembered the unusual things that had happened to me. Once, I had found the perfect shed skin of a rattlesnake. My mother told my father that this indicated my potential for science. I was on the roof another time when it hailed apricot-sized balls of ice on a summer afternoon. The day was hot, and there was only one cloud. But as it approached from the distance, it spread a shaft of darkness below it, as if it had fallen through itself to the earth. And when it reached the New Jerusalem, the river began throwing up spouts of water. Then it crossed onto land, and I could see the hailstones denting parked cars. I went back inside the attic and watched it pass, and when I came outside again and picked up the ice balls that rolled between the corrugated roof spouts, their prickly edges melted in my fingers. In a minute, they were gone. That was the rarest thing that had ever happened to me. Now I waited for rare things, because it seemed to me that if you traced back the lives of men, you arrived at some sort of sign, rainstorm at one horizon and sunlight at the other. On the roof, I waited for mine. Sometimes I thought about the woman, and sometimes I looked for silhouettes in the blue shapes between the clouds. "Your father thinks you should be thinking about the store," said my mother.
"I know."
"You'll own the store someday." There was a carpet of cirrus clouds in the distance, and we watched them as their bottom edges were gradually lit by the rising moon. My mother tilted back her head and looked up into the stars. "What beautiful names," she said. "Cassiopeia, Lyra, Aquila."
"The Big Dipper," I said.
"Dade?"
"Yes."
"I saw the lady come in yesterday."
"I didn't chase her."
"I know."
"What do you think of that?"
"I think you're doing more important things," she said. "Dreams are more important than rye bread."
She took the bobby pins from her hair and held them in her palm.
"Dade, tell me the truth. What do you think about when you come up here?"
In the distance, there were car lights, trees, aluminum power poles. There were several ways I could have answered. I said, "I think I'm about to make a discovery." After that, my mother began meeting me at the bottom of the stairs when I came down from the roof. She smiled expectantly. I snapped my fingers, tapped my feet. I blinked and looked at my canvas shoe tips. She kept smiling. I didn't like this, so I tried not coming down for entire afternoons, but this only made her look more expectant. On the roof, my thoughts piled into one another. I couldn't even think of something that was undiscovered. I stood and thought about the woman. Then my mother began leaving little snacks on the sill of the dormer window. Crackers, cut apples, apricots. She arranged them in fan shapes or twirls on a plate, and after a few days I started working regular hours again. I wore my smock and checked customers through the register and went upstairs only in the evenings. I came down after my mother had gone to sleep. I was afraid the woman was coming back, but I couldn't face my mother twice a day at the bottom of the stairs. So I worked and looked up at the door whenever customers entered. I did stock work when I could, stayed in back where the air was refrigerated, but I sweated anyway. I unloaded melons, tuna fish, cereal. I counted the cases of freeze pops, priced the cans of All-American ham. At the swinging door between the stockroom and the back of the store, my heart went dizzy. The woman knew something about me. In the evenings on the roof, I tried to think what it was. I saw mysterious new clouds, odd combinations of cirrus and stratus. How did she root me into the linoleum floor with her gray stare? Above me on the roof, the sky was simmering. It was blue gas. I knew she was coming back.
It was raining when she did. The door opened, and I felt the wet breeze, and when I looked up, she was standing with her back to me in front of the shelves of cheese and dairy, and this time I came out from the counter and stopped behind her. She smelled of the rain outside.
"Look," I whispered. "Why are you doing this to me?"
She didn't turn around. I moved closer. I was gathering my words, thinking of the blue index card, when the idea of limited fame came into my head. I stopped. How did human beings understand each other across huge spaces except with the lowest of ideas? I have never understood what it is about rain that smells, but as I stood there behind the woman, I suddenly realized I was smelling the inside of clouds. What was between us at that moment was an idea we had created ourselves. When she left with a carton of milk in her hand, I couldn't speak. On the roof that evening, I looked into the sky, out over the plains, along the uneven horizon. I thought of the view my father had seen when he was a young man. I wondered whether he had imagined star food then. The sun was setting, the blues and oranges were mixing into black, and in the distance windows were lighting up along the hillsides. "Tell me what I want," I said then. I moved closer to the edge of the eaves and repeated it. I looked down over the alley, into the kitchens across the way, into living rooms, bedrooms, across slate rooftops. "Tell me what I want," I called. Cars pulled in and out of the parking lot. Big rigs rushed by on the interstate. The air around me was as cool as water, the lighted swimming pools like pieces of the daytime sky. An important moment seemed to be rushing up. "Tell me what I want," I said again. Then, I heard my father open the window and come out onto the roof. He walked down and stood next to me, the bald spot on top of his head reflecting the streetlight. He took out a cigarette, smoked it for a while, pinched off the end. A bird fluttered around the light pole just across the street. A car crossed below us with the words, "Just married," on the roof. "Look," he said, "your mother's tried to make me understand this." He paused to put the unsmoked butt back in the pack. "And maybe I can. You think the gal's a little down and out? You don't want to kick her when she's down. Okay? I can understand that. So I've decided something. And you want to know what?" He shifted his hands in his pockets and took a few steps toward the edge of the roof. "You want to know what?"
"What?"
"I'm taking you off the hook. Your mother says you've got a few thoughts, that maybe you're on the verge of something, so I decided it's okay if you let the lady go if she comes in again."
"What?"
"I said it's okay if you let the gal go. You don't have to chase her."
"You're gonna let her steal?"
"No," he said. "I hired a guard." He was there the next morning in clothes that were all dark blue, pants, shirt, cap, socks. He was only 2 or 3 years older than I was. My father introduced him to me as Mr. Sellers. "Mr. Sellers," he said, "this is Dade." He had a badge on his chest and a ring of keys the size of a donut on his belt. At the door, he sat jingling them. I didn't say much to him, and when I did, my father came out from the back and counted register receipts or stocked impulse items near where he sat. We weren't saying anything important, though. Mr. Sellers didn't carry a gun, only the donut-sized key ring, so I asked him if he wished he did.
"Sure," he said.
"Would you use it?"
"If I had to."
I thought of him using his gun if he had to. His hands were thick and their backs were covered with hair. This seemed to go along with shooting somebody if he had to. My hands were thin and white, and the hair on them was like the hair on a girl's cheek. During the days he stayed by the front, he smiled at customers and held the door for them, and my father brought him sodas every hour or so. Whenever the guard smiled at a customer, I thought of him trying to decide whether he was looking at the shoplifter. And then, one evening, everything changed. I was on the roof. The sun was low, throwing slanted light. From beyond the New Jerusalem and behind the hills, 4 Air Force jets appeared. They disappeared, then appeared again, silver dots trailing white tails. They climbed and cut and looped back, showing the dark and light like a school of fish. When they turned against the sun, their wings flashed. Between the hills and the river, they dipped low onto the plain, then shot upward and toward me. One dipped, the others followed. Across the New Jerusalem, they turned back and made two great circles, one inside the other, then dipped again and leveled off in my direction. The sky seemed small enough for them to fall through. I could see the double tails, then the wings and the jets. From across the river, they shot straight toward the store, angling up so I could see the V-wings and camouflage and rounded bomb bays. And I covered my ears, and in a moment they were across the water, and then they were above me. And as they passed over, they barrel-rolled and flew upside down and showed me their black cockpit glass so that my heart came up into my mouth. I stood there while they turned again behind me and lifted back toward the hills, trailing threads of vapor. And by the time their boom subsided, I knew I wanted the woman to be caught. I had seen a sign. Suddenly the sky was water clear, distances moved in, houses stood out against the hills, and it seemed to me that I had turned a corner and now looked over a rain-washed street. The woman was a thief. This was a simple fact, and it presented itself to me simply. I felt the world dictating its course. I went downstairs and told my father I was ready to catch her. He looked at me, rolled the chewing gum in his cheek.
I'll be damned.
My life is making sense, I said. When I unloaded potato chips that night, I laid the bags in the aluminum racks as if I were putting children to sleep in their beds. Dust had gathered under the lip of the vegetable bins, so I swept and mopped there and ran a wet cloth over the stalls. My father slapped me on the back a couple of times. In school once, I had looked through a microscope at the tip of my own finger, and now as I looked around the store, everything seemed to have been magnified in the same way. I saw cracks in the linoleum floor, speckles of color in the walls. This kept up for a couple of days, and all the time I waited for the woman to come in. After a while, it was more than just waiting. I looked forward to the day when she would return. In my eyes, she would find nothing but resolve. How bright the store seemed to me then when I swept. How velvety the skins of the melons beneath the sprayer bottle. When I went up to the roof, I scrubbed the star with a wet cloth and came back down. I didn't stare into the clouds, and I didn't think about the woman except with the thought of catching her. I described her perfectly for the guard, her gray eyes, her plaid dress. After I started working like this, my mother began to go to the back room in the afternoons and listen to music. When I swept the rear, I heard the melodies of operas. They came from behind the stockroom door while I waited for the woman to return. And when my mother came out, she had a look about her of disappointment. Her skin was pale and smooth, as if the blood had run to deeper parts.
"Dade," she said one afternoon as I stacked tomatoes in a pyramid, "it's easy to lose your dreams."
"I'm just stacking tomatoes." She went back to the register. I went back to stacking, and my father, who'd been patting me on the back, winking at me from behind the butcher counter, came over and helped me.
"I notice your mother's been talking to you."
"A little." We finished the tomatoes and moved on to the lettuce.
"Look," he said, "it's better to do what you have to do, so I wouldn't spend your time worrying frontwards and backwards about everything. Your life's not so long as you think it's going to be."
We stood there rolling heads of butterball lettuce up the shallow incline of the display cart. Next to me, he smelled like aqua velva.
"The lettuce is looking good," I said. Then I went up to the front of the store.
"I'm not sure what my dreams are," I said to my mother. "And I'm never going to discover anything. All I've ever done on the roof is look at the clouds."
Then the door opened, and the woman came in. I was standing in front of the counter, hands in my pockets, my mother's eyes watering over, the guard looking out the window at a couple of girls, everything revolving around the point of calm that, in retrospect, precedes surprises. I'd been waiting for her for a week, and now she came in. I realized I never expected her. She stood looking at me, and for a few moments I looked back. Then she realized what I was up to. She turned around to leave. And when her back was to me, I stepped over and grabbed her. I've never liked fishing much, even though I used to go with my father, because the moment a fish jumps on my line a tree's length away in the water, I feel as if I've suddenly lost something. I'm always disappointed and sad. But now, as I held the woman beneath the shoulder, I felt none of this disappointment. I felt strong and good. She was thin, and I could make out the bones and tendons in her arm. As I led her back toward the stockroom, through the bread aisle, then the potato chips that were puffed and stacked like a row of pillows, I heard my mother begin to weep behind the register. Then my father came up behind me. I didn't turn around, but I knew he was there, and I knew the deliberately calm way he was walking. "I'll be back as soon as I dust the melons," he said. I held the woman tightly under her arm, but despite this she moved in a light way, and suddenly, as we paused before the stockroom door, I felt as if I were leading her onto the dance floor. This flushed me with remorse. "Don't spend your whole life looking backwards and forwards," I said to myself. "Know what you want." I pushed the door open and we went in. The room was dark. It smelled of my whole life. I turned on the light and sat her down in the straight-back chair, then crossed the room and stood against the door. I had spoken to many children as they sat in this chair. I had frightened them, collected the candy they had tried to hide between the cushions, presented it to my father when he came in. Now I looked at the blue card. "Do you know what you have done?" it said. "Do you know what it is to steal?" I tried to think of what to say to the woman. She sat trembling slightly. I approached the chair and stood in front of her. She looked up at me. Her hair was gray around the roots. "Do you want to go out of the back?" I said. She stood up and I took the key from under the silver samovar. My father would be there in a moment, so after I let her out, I took my coat from the hook and followed. The evening was misty. She crossed the lot, and I hurried and came up next to her. We walked fast and stayed behind cars, and when we had gone a distance, I turned and looked back. The stockroom door was closed. On the roof, the star cast a pale light that whitened the aluminum-sided eaves. It seemed we would be capable of a great communication now, but as we walked, I realized I didn't know what to say to her. We went down the street without talking. The traffic was light, evening was approaching, and as we passed below some trees, the streetlights suddenly came on. This moment has always amazed me. I knew the woman had seen it too, but it was always a disappointment to mention a thing like this. The streets and buildings took on their night shapes. Still, we didn't say anything to each other. We kept walking beneath the pale violet of the lamps, and after a few more blocks, I just stopped at one corner. She went on, crossed the street, and I lost sight of her. I stood there until the world had rotated fully into the night, and for a while I tried to make myself aware of the spinning of the earth. Then I walked back toward the store. When they slept that night, my mother would dream of discovery, and my father would dream of low-grade crooks. When I thought of this and the woman, I was sad. It seemed you could never really know another person. I felt alone in the world, in the way that makes me aware of sound and temperature, as if I had just left a movie theater and stepped into an alley where a light rain was falling, and the wind was cool, and from somewhere, other people's voices could be heard.